Good morning. It was a throwback this week to the era of the lovely girls. Tipperary TD Michael Lowry illuminated the path. He wrote a note which was passed to Enda Kenny in the Dáil Chamber, interceding on behalf of Valerie O'Reilly, an outgoing member of the National Transport Authority.
Taoiseach, would you please consider reappointing Valerie O'Reilly to the board of the National Transport Authority? A woman, bright, intelligent, and not bad looking either.
Well, somehow that note found its way into the hands of Daniel McConnell of the Sunday Independent, who published it. But when Áine Lawler spoke with Michael Lowry on Monday's News at One, he said he'd no regrets about asking the Taoiseach to reappoint Valerie O'Reilly.
I do that every day of the week. I live in the real world. Last week alone, I wrote a reference for a young man who was out of employment for 2 years. He rang me on Friday to compliment me on the reference he gave me and said that it led to a situation where my endorsement of his job qualifications led him to a permanent job. We do that in politics, Áine.
So you're an equal opportunities reference writer, but did you write about his looks, for instance, in that reference?
Well, you know, Áine, on the looks, that was a light-hearted, unnecessary comment that I made. But I have to say, since you people in the media, since you're so politically correct, I have to say to you, Áine, that I've never had a situation where a woman took exception to a compliment on her appearance, on her nice dress or on a nice pair of shoes or hairstyle. And, you know, are you telling me that a politician is not allowed to make a compliment?
Michael, is there not a big difference between a private compliment and a sexist comment in a reference for a state job?
It wasn't meant to be a sexist comment.
But what have her looks got to do with her capability for a state board?
I've already said to you that her capabilities are well proven. Her CV speaks for herself. Her contribution to the board speaks for herself. And I've already said it was a light-hearted comment and it was an unnecessary comment. And, you know,
It's a bit farther, Ted, isn't it, Michael Lowry?
Well, I suppose if you want to take on your fellow journalists and say, I read last week 3 pages of articles in relation to the media commenting on how elegant and striking Christine Lagarde was. I've read the media commentary in relation to how good-looking and glamorous the Italian Euro Commissioner was.
And so do you think Christine Lagarde, Michael Lowry, if you were passing her a note recommending somebody for a job, do you think Christine Lagarde would appreciate it if you said, added on, and not bad-looking either? Do you think that would impress Christine Lagarde?
I say, Áine, the first thing Christine Lagarde would do, the same as the Taoiseach would do and the same as the Minister for Transport would do, is look at the qualifications of the individual that you were making the reference for, and if deemed to be suitable applicant, then they get consideration. I simply looked for consideration for somebody who was already on the board to be reappointed on the basis of the past contribution. That was all.
Tipperary TD Michael Lowry. And there were other goings on in Leinster House. A story broken by RTE journalist Ken Fox put Mayo TD Michelle Mulhern at the centre of a controversy over expensive mobile phone calls made to a person in Kenya. Deputy Mulhern spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
Yes, I made some calls to Africa. None of them were personal. And indeed, for the most part, they were pertained to a third party who was a private citizen who had been maligned and defamed in a newspaper article because of association with me and potential legal action arising therefrom. So I'm not really at liberty to go into that further. But what I can say is that I understand at all times in relation to the use of the phones, which is, I suppose, the same as how people would operate in business. It's not for personal, it's for business. And my phone calls were not personal.
When you talk about those calls being made in the course of your work as a TD having to do with an individual who was maligned in the media, is this the person that you were friendly with who helped in your campaign? I think, if I pronounce his name correctly, Danson Cole?
I don't want to be going into this third party situation to add insult to injury, but yes, the individual who was maligned and defamed was that third party. And as I say, there are more people who are connected with the revelations or the spurious information that was given in a particular newspaper article, and they are private citizens, and I don't want to be going into it.
Right, but can you just clarify, he's the person who was maligned, as you say, in the media. Is he the person to whom you made the phone calls?
Yes, in relation to that particular matter, yeah.
Right, so where does the third party come into this then?
Well, he is a third-party private citizen.
And the deputy was also concerned that with the emergence of this story, politicians' confidentiality in dealing with potential whistleblowers and the likes could be compromised.
Maybe the big question is, as well, is there a matter here that has to do with taxpayers' money being spent on personal phone calls?
Okay, In relation to that, I have confirmed to you it isn't. I actually, being honest with you, I don't have a personal life. All my life is pretty much taken up with politics, and that's every day of the week. I haven't got the liberty of having long, lengthy personal phone calls out of Leinster House.
I know, but you would remember making long phone
calls. I wonder, is this story just to do with the cost to the taxpayer? Or might I suggest that there's an attraction to link my personal life, as it has been in the past, with someone in Africa, and to go down that route, and it is of interest to certain sectors of the media, that angle would be taken on it. I mean, there's calls made all over the world there, so there is. There's from Qatar to Colombia, several calls to Colombia. This is bigger than Michelle Mulhern,
and
this will be sorted. What I'm saying is, there's a total confidentiality issue here in relation to how politicians can do their business with people, which is political business.
Mayo TD Michelle Mulhern, who said she'd no problem refunding the cost of the mobile calls, even though they were made in the course of her work. Well, as a lovely girl myself, it was all Greek to me. On Sunday night, Alexis Tsipras, leader of the radical left-wing Syriza party, romped to victory as prime minister in the elections in Greece. By Tuesday, he already had his cabinet in place, an alliance with the far-right Independent Greeks party. RTE's Europe editor, Tony Connolly, sampled the atmosphere as people partied on the streets of Athens.
We are extremely happy. We are hopeful. We can't take it anymore. People are not afraid anymore.
We're extremely happy today because we feel that change has begun, that history has knocked on our door, and I think that it's time for the state to change completely.
But this woman wasn't convinced.
Well, you can't go to the market or go to Mrs. Merkel or whoever is in charge, or the IMF or the Troika, as it's called, and you can't go there with a country that produces nothing, we produce nothing, and go and say, oh, I don't like the terms of the contract, so please, I don't like 2% that you give me the loan, I'm not going to pay. You can't do that.
Well, there may be a new government in place, but Greece is still massively in debt to the tune of €323 billion, including the €240 billion bailout negotiated with the Eurozone countries, the ECB and the IMF. Prime Minister Tsipras got elected on a promise of renegotiating the terms of the bailout. Mary Wilson spoke with Paul Mason of Channel 4 about his chances of delivering on his pre-election promises.
Give us some sort of a timeline here, Paul. The first cabinet meeting, I understand, takes place tomorrow. But in the next 2 months, the Greek state faces €4 billion in maturing debt repayments.
Yeah, they've got €4 billion in maturing debt repayments, and they're also due some money from the European Union, and they're also due some money, quite a lot of money, €12 billion from the IMF. So, you know, let's presume the IMF and the EC don't say, well, you're not having it, you're not playing ball. One of the beauties of the bailout agreement, and I think Ireland has this as well, is that you get asked to keep a large cash reserve. Now, the Greeks have got €7 billion cash in the government coffers because of the bail. You know, that's the condition. So they've got €7 billion to play with. So I think they'll get through. On debt terms, they'll get through to about June. They are hoping to have they want a big European conference to wrap this up. But it's the back half of 2015 where the debt becomes an issue, but the bank emergency lending assistance becomes an issue on the 28th of Feb if they haven't signed a new agreement.
Well, from austerity in Greece to continued anger about austerity measures in this country, this is what President Michael D. Higgins met last Friday when anti-water charge protesters chased after his car and barracked him as he left a school in Finglas in Dublin. On the news at 1, the Anti-Austerity Alliance TD Paul Murphy condemned the verbal abuse but insisted the president was a legitimate target for protest in a democracy. He spoke with Fran McNulty.
What would you say to the people who are name-calling, calling people a parasite and scumbags to their face, including the president of this country? What would you say to them specifically?
I would urge them not to engage in personal abuse. It's clearly wrong in and of itself, but it's also utterly unhelpful for the anti-water charges movement for that kind of personal abuse to be used. But at the same time, while I don't agree tactically with the protest, and so I don't think there was really a purpose in this protest, it's not part of my strategic vision of how we'll be meet the water charges. I defend their right to protest nonetheless, and I don't accept the kind of legal formalism that says the president is above politics, it's impossible, nobody is ever allowed to protest against them. I think it's fair enough for people to protest against him in a peaceful manner, yes.
The president.
He's elected, he speaks against austerity, he speaks for human rights. People had the wrong impression that he would, say, refer the act to the Council of State, perhaps refuse to sign it. Many people had that expectation, and there was a massive disappointment of people in him for not doing so. And I understand that, and I defend people's rights to protest.
And Labour TD John Lyons said the people of Finglas wanted to disassociate themselves from the thuggery.
This does not reflect the broader people of Finglas, and that's what I believe. I think it's disgraceful, and people should be ashamed of themselves. And you know, the president is above politics. The president is our president, as in mine, yours, and everybody else, and the people who went to Claustone. And they really should be ashamed of themselves. That is a new meaning to what I thought a peaceful protest is.
And of course, the subject lit up the live line with Joe Duffy. On Thursday night, Anne Enright was named as the inaugural Irish Laureate for Fiction at a ceremony in the Arts Council in Dublin. Taoiseach Enda Kenny said her eloquent and powerful writing, fiercely individual voice and unyielding commitment to her craft combined to make her the preeminent choice. The Laureate will represent Irish literature here and abroad over the next 3 years. Anne Enright told Sean Rocks on Arena about her new role.
We are Irish writers as a group. Have gone about the place for a very long time representing something undefined, which is, you know, some great idea of ourselves, perhaps, or some collegiate idea of the Irish writer, the Irish tradition. We're always representing this amazing crucible of talent that Ireland is and has been over the last centuries. So it's just crystallising that, you know what I mean? It's labelling it, it's putting a name on it. And so the next time, you know, I put on the good shoes and the smile, it will be with a different or a more serious intent.
I noticed just looking at, you know, some of the different ideas that some of the selection committee had in terms of the role. Blake Morrison spoke about how poet laureates in Britain, for example, he being a British writer, that they often speak out against the state. Deborah Treisman, the American writer, was very clear that she thinks, no, this is representing a genre. It's not representing a nation, as it were. And the Colombian writer, Juan Gabriel Vasquez, coming from his background, he saw the writer as having quite a strong role in terms of voicing, perhaps, in terms of freedom of speech, possibly against the state. Do you see the role as having a political aspect to it?
A writer is not a tame creature. And I don't think this is an attempt to tame the writer, even for 3 years at a stretch. And the reason writers aren't tame is because you can't legislate, manufacture or fake creativity. Creativity has its own movement, its own energy. It's not authoritative sometimes it is authoritative. Anyway, but whatever way it moves, it's a wild thing. So anything that cuts across that honesty and that energy, I wouldn't be keen on, I have to say.
And Anne Enright had this advice for wannabe writers on The John Murray Show.
Before I packed in the day job, I published my first book, and so I spent the weekends writing a first book of short stories before I left this venerable institution called RTE in 1993, I think. And I think you need a little bridge. You need just to put a plank down from one job to the next job. So don't throw everything up in the air. But my advice to writers is to get over yourself. It's like, you know, people say it's really hard, and I look at them like, yeah, and they say my book isn't, I can't write my book, and I'm going, yeah, so yeah, that's the gig.
Yes,
just keep at it.
The Irish Laureate for Fiction, Anne Enright, who will do us all proud. Well, there were many talented women on The Murray Show this week. Singer-songwriter Eddie Reader is a committed campaigner for Scottish independence. And John wondered how she felt when she was awarded the MBE by the Queen of England.
Well, when I got an MBE, which was about 2006 or something, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is member of the British Empire. Well, first of all, I don't think there is an empire anymore. And then second of all, I know that it's civil servants that tell the Queen this person deserves a bit of a pat on the back. So it's a medal from a person who's a queen. I'm not really convinced that it's a political issue. I think that people make it a political issue, but I don't think it is. I just think it's, you know, they gave one to Bill Gates and he lives in America, and they gave one to Bob Geldof, and I'm not sure Ireland want to be run by the British Empire anymore, you know what I mean? I don't think I don't think just because somebody gives you a medal means you've got to adhere to all the old structure, you know what I mean?
So you take it and run, yes.
I took it and wore a hat and my mother put her best gear on and we all went and got pictures taken and then we got kicked out. Basically, the MBE is really good for reporters and all that because it sort of gives them a sort of thing to talk about. But I prefer to talk about my... my honorary degrees, by the way, lads.
Many of
just
them.
Telling you.
How many of them have you?
I've got four, and I never went. I never stayed on at school, and I've got four of them. Yeah.
So you're doctor by four.
It did backfire on me one time in a hotel because I was feeling a bit annoyed because she kept saying, "Do you want to be Miss, Ms, or Ms?" And I was like, "I'm doctor, actually." And then the next morning at 6:30, she phoned me up and says, "Taxi's here for the doctor's convention." And I'm like,
"Lovely, lovely, lovely."
Eddie Reader, who is about to set off on a nationwide tour here.
I'll sing Baby's Boat just to wake us up.
And
it's about, you know, our kids leaving us. Right. Sail, baby, sail, out upon the sea. Only don't forget to come back to me. And don't get anybody pregnant, please. Not yet, anyway. Nate Egypt. All right.
Off you go.
Baby's boat, a silver moon sailing in the sky. Baby's fish for dreams, fishing near and far for dreams. Sail, baby, sail out upon the sea. Only don't forget, sail back to me.
Eddie Reader, one of Scotland's finest. And in the poetry programme last Saturday night, the first in a brand new season, Ricochet spoke with Liz Lockhead, Scotland's national poet.
You know, if Scotland win the Six Nations in rugby or if Scotland had voted for independence, is that the sort of thing that you then have to write something about?
You don't have to do anything. It's very nice. But they do ask you, would you do this or that? They asked me to write a poem for the opening of the last parliament. I think it was 2 years ago just now.
And she came up with this jewel, encouraging people to join the children's panel. The panel looks after children who've committed a crime or who've been victims of abuse or crime. Trouble is not my middle name.
Trouble is not my middle name. It is not what I am. I was not born for this. Trouble is not a place. Though I am in it deeper than the deepest wood, and I'd get out of it, who wouldn't, if I could. Hope is what I do not have in hell. Not without good help now. Could you listen hard and well to what I cannot say except by what I do? And when you say I do it for badness, this much is true. I do it for badness done to me before any badness that I do to you. Hard to unfankle this, but you can help me. Maybe. Loosen all these knots and really listen. I cannot plainly tell you this, but if you care, then beyond all harm and hurt, real hope is there.
Liz Lockhead, and you can hear another edition of the poetry programme tonight at 7:30 here on RTE Radio 1, produced by Claire Cunningham. You know, poetry is definitely the new black. On Thursday on RTÉ Television, Julian Hill's sublime documentary, A Rebel Act, explored how central poetry is to our lives. And you may remember last year the John Murray Show joined forces with The Works on RTÉ Television to find Ireland's best-loved poem of the past 100 years. Well, the poems you nominated have now been whittled down to a final 10. A difficult job for jury members, including Anne Doyle and Damien Dempsey.
As is often the case, my contribution might have been on the common touch lines. There was quite a high academic level amongst the jurors. I found it fascinating. I found it a wonderful learning curve. I was quite surprised to see how biased I was at the start. That unfolded as time went on. And I'm hoping that my personal experience of learning, of having my mind opened, is what this is actually going to mean to other people. It has already meant that from, you know, the number of people who have participated in nominations. And now that we're down to that short list of 10, I think that that will make people's interest even keener. And it means, you know, they may find that, like me, they don't spend all their lives lurking at the Scandi Noir crime thrillers. They start hanging out at the poetry section as well. I hope so. That's what it's done for me.
Damien, were you surprised at the range of poems nominated by the public?
It was a massive range. You just realise the richness of poetry in this small island, really, you know. Dan was the common touch and I was a sort of layman, you know, brought in. But yeah, me and Anne disagreed over a couple of poems and we had to go toe-to-toe, but Anne fights dirty, so I came off the worst.
Tell us more, Anne.
Look, after 30 years in the newsroom, you'd have to be a street fighter, John, you know that.
Legend Anne Doyle with singer-songwriter Damien Dempsey, heard on the John Murray Show yesterday. Marty Morrissey's studio was packed to the gunnels on Wednesday. Not only did he have the six singing Willoughby brothers and keyboard player Ollie Hennessy from County Wicklow, his other guest was Avril Mulcahy, who runs her own matchmaking agency. She's just written a book called Go Get 'Em, a handy guide on how to make that bad boy or woman fall in love with you. It wasn't long before Agony Aunt Brenda Donoghue got down to the nitty-gritty.
But say a woman hits a certain age and there's a biological clock and it starts to go tick tock, tick tock, tick tock. And there's kind of, oh my God, I have to get married. I have to meet somebody. Look at all my friends are getting married. They're engagement parties. Now I'm going to christening parties. I'm asked to be a godmother. And I have nobody. And they go in and there's kind of a desperation there. How do you get over? Because that's harder for a woman. And men don't really have that. So what would you say to women in that position where they're feeling desperate? And they're giving off that vibe.
Yeah, I actually do think that men have it because society says that one man plus one woman equals happiness. And we all know that's complete tripe. There's a whole load of people in relationships and they're not happy. But we've bought into this whole thing. And, you know, the desperate, vulnerable character, that is an ugly character to go out with. So you need to pull yourself back and say, you know, something, make yourself happy before you ever go out there.
Five of the six brothers have wives or partners or whatever. Where did you meet your wife, for instance?
I met my wife in Ballina, where I moved up to in the Blessington Lakes. So I was working with a band up there and I went into a local pub and she came in and she fell in love with me straight away.
Well, would you blame her?
And with voices like this.
Can anybody tell me where the Blarney roses grow? Some say down in Limerick town and more say in Mayo. It's somewhere in the Emerald Island, this I want to know.
In the glens of Antrim, near the Count of Cushendall, one morn I met a damsel there, the fairest of them all. 'Twas with my young affections and my money she did go. She told me she'd belong to where the Blarney roses grow. Her cheeks were like red roses and her hair a raven hue. Before that she had done with me, she had me raving too. She left me sorely stranded, not a kind she left, you know. The damsel that belonged to where the Blarney roses grow.
Can anybody tell me where the Blarney roses grow? Some say down in Limerick town and more say in Mayo. It's somewhere in the Emerald Island, this I want to know. Can anybody tell me where the Blarney roses grow?
The Willoughby brothers from Blessington in County Wicklow. Well, there was a sparky debate on the Today Show this week on whether Operation Transformation is a superficial reality show or an important part of a campaign for better health. Well, I know where I stand. I wouldn't miss it, and I think it's a real catalyst for change. But this week, it emerged that three of the leaders had not reached their target weight. One of them, Eilish Kavanagh from Bunclody, had gone to the races at Goran Park, knocked back a few drinks, and generally had a great day out for herself. Dietitian Aoife Hearn and Dr. Ciara Kelly were less than impressed, but Eilish was having none of it.
For me, that one day just felt like throwing caution to the wind and not caring, you know?
No, that's not right. I did care. I looked everything up on the internet. My food was perfect for the day. I did my exercises.
but the alcohol was an extra maybe 600 or 700, maybe more, calories added into the day.
Did you feel that everything was going to be okay after that, like, because you hadn't checked and done your food?
I knew it wasn't going to be okay because I was a bit worried about today. But I worked my socks off the week before, knowing I had the day coming up.
You're supposed to work hard every week. This week was an abomination, and I was embarrassed for you, and I was disgusted to see you. You let the programme down, you let your followers down, and with respect to you, Eilish, you let yourself down. Operation Transformation is about the country getting healthy, and one of our five leaders went out this week and got drunk on TV.
That's
and
not
thought
true,
it was great.
Girl. I didn't get drunk.
It's what it looked like. And I was disgusted because there are people around the country who are following you. There are young people watching this show. There are kids watching this show. And I thought that that was appalling. I might have expected it from one of our younger leaders, but you are not one of our younger leaders.
Realistically, I thought, you know, for the 8 weeks, I'm not going to give up alcohol. So I said, there's no point in fooling myself for 8 weeks and not having a drink. So I said it was the one social day that I do have, mm-hmm. that I was going to have a few drinks. And I Googled it and see what I was allowed.
But that 11 units is the maximum amount we recommend people to have from a health perspective mm-hmm. over an entire week.
Look, I made a mistake. I had a few drinks, had a good day. It's life.
I'd say Eilish won't be risking a day at the races this week, from the John Murray Show on Wednesday. Well, John also took time out to take a trip on the Dart from Greystones to Howth, stopping off at some of the beautiful coastal villages along the way. His guide was David O'Hora, who's just written a book called Dublin Off the Dart.
We're just after getting off the train at Sandy Cove and we're headed down the street. Where are we headed to, Dave?
We're heading to the middle of the Glastool village, which is just, it's an amazing find. Again, I had forgotten until we did the book last year, just how much of a village and a place in itself it is. It's right beside Dunleary, but it's very much a place of its own.
And Dave, you were telling me about one of the restaurants here, the Indian Rassam, and its connection with the IMF team that were sorting out the country.
Nobody knew the IMF were coming, and the first day they arrived, later on that evening, the man who owns Rassam, which is famous, not just in Dublin, over, and got a phone call to say, could he stay open late, because there was 12 very important people coming. So what became Ireland's last supper became their first supper in Glasgow. You're spoiled for choice with restaurants in Glastool and Sandy Cove, but we're about to enter the mecca of one of the Dublin's great food characters and a great music man, Caviston's of Glastool. Peter Caviston.
So how are you getting on?
Not too bad at all. Now we're on a trip in the dark today.
Well, welcome to Sandy Cove, Glastool and Scotsman's Bay, the beautiful home of Joyce.
Plenty busy here as well.
But we're here only 60-something years, mm-hmm. as we're blowing to Glastool and we're... We've a lovely selection of fish. Beautiful, large place there. Look at the haddocks. Look at the colours of the fish. That's the most important thing.
Fishmonger Peter Caviston heard on The Murray Show on Monday. It's impossible for many of us to even begin to imagine what life must be like for those who survived the Nazi death camps during the Second World War. More than 6 million Jews die there. And on Tuesday, 70 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, many of the survivors, elderly men and women, along with European leaders, gathered there to pay witness to the Holocaust. Rose Schindler and Mordecai Ronan were only children when they arrived at Auschwitz.
I remember it like it would happen right now. We came in, got in the train, the train stopped. An inmate comes on the train in a striped uniform. He says to me, how old are you? I said, I am 14. He says, tell him you're 18. They saved my life. Because I was 18, not 14. 18-year-olds can work. Because what they did in those days, Hitler didn't even have enough gas to kill all the people. They would push them out of the oven and burn them half alive. Can you imagine what that could do to a person? Seeing your own mother and sisters and brothers sitting in a floor and choking and then being burned half alive.
My mother and my two sisters, they went right away to crematorium. When we came with the train, they told us to go out. And we started to walk and they said, whoever they took us down from the train, if you see the flames there, you are going to be burned alive. That's what happened. to my father and mother and my two sisters.
From Christopher McKevitt's report from Auschwitz, heard on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. It's been a long road to justice for Fiona Doyle, but on Monday the Court of Appeal imposed a more severe sentence than a lower court on her 74-year-old father, who'd abused and raped her when she was a child. Patrick O'Brien was jailed for 9 years following a finding by the Court of Appeal that his original sentence of 3 years was too lenient. And as Fiona Doyle told Mary Wilson, she walked out of court not a victim, but a survivor.
What you're left with as a victim of abuse, it's a lifetime sentence. It's a lifetime of flashbacks. It's a lifetime of horrible smells. It's a lifetime of nightmares. So the consequences of abuse to a victim is lifetime. So it didn't balance out that he was going to serve 2 years and 3 months. He was due for release this April coming. And it just didn't balance out. So I was afraid it would make people reluctant to stand up. So I felt it was my duty to fight it. So it's a constant battle. And then to finally be heard was just such relief.
And in a way today, with that decision from the Court of Appeal to turn the sentence around, if you like, and insist that he serve 9 of that 12-year sentence with only 3 suspended, in a way you're making some legal history, because the Court of Appeal has set down certain statements around elderly people and being able to serve lengthy jail sentences.
My father's legal team used his health as a defence. They had letters there saying he had this wrong with him and that wrong with him, and he had this ailment and that ailment and his age, and they put up a defence saying that he wouldn't cope with prison, and it's all being turned on them now. The prison can cope with it, and that their age shouldn't be a factor, and neither should their health.
Do you care what happens to him now? You know he's in jail for the next 9 years.
God, no. Mind you, if you had have asked me that 2 years ago, I was caring, and it just goes to show the power of counselling. I've been in counselling, and I have progressed, and I don't see that as being my father anymore, or I don't have concern or worries over him going to prison. He survived 2 years and he can take on the rest. He's the only one responsible for why he's there, not me. He has to pay the price for his actions, not me.
Fiona Doyle with Mary Wilson on Monday's Drive Time. Forgiveness was at the heart of Miriam O'Callaghan's programme last Sunday. It's just over 30 years since the IRA tried to kill British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and her cabinet while they were attending the Tory party conference in Brighton. Patrick McGee was the man who planted the bomb at the Grand Hotel, and he received 8 life sentences. He was eventually released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. Miriam's other guest was Jo Berry, the daughter of Sir Anthony Berry, who was murdered by Pat McGee, the Brighton bomber. Both are now committed to conflict resolution.
Can you remember, both of you, the first words you exchanged at the first meeting?
I do remember standing at Anne Gallagher's door and it suddenly hitting home the enormity of what I was about to do, to go through that door and meet somebody whose father had killed. So when I walked in and met Joe, it was a very scary moment. It was definitely a scary moment.
But I was so curious. I remember looking at you, Pat, and thinking, you planted a bomb that killed my dad, but who are you? Who are you other than that? And just really curious as to how you were in your normal life. And so I think that's why it carried on for so long. It started off with Pat justifying to me, and he did do it with some sensitivity, but he was coming with a political justification. And I remember at the end of 3 hours, it was so intense. And I had different parts of me thinking different things and saying, and I couldn't sustain it anymore. And I knew I had to go, so I thanked Pat. And he said, I'm really sorry I killed your father. And it was said with a lot of feeling.
Pat McGee and Jo Berry heard on Sunday with Miriam. I was listening to Radio na Gaeltachta on Tuesday. Helen Ní Hay's programme on Saol Ó Dheas, which broadcasts from Kirkaguina, featured the Seanó singer Seosamhíní Bheagla and her brother, the box player and singer Seamus Begley. Seosamhíní's just been appointed adjunct professor at the Conservatory of Music in DIT, so there was talk of education and music. But amongst the memories they shared were those of their friend, the legendary Kerry footballer Paddy O'Shea, who died 2 years ago.
Screening be a party, law, it'd have owned. You'd have envoyed by enough, I can listen. ich sehe von Agassaram, a Fierigum, doch Sherry Schmidt. Kashi Gavriel, look to let, look to let, look to let, Rahim, Sherry Schmidt, sicher. Wir haben gleich daher noch wenig, wie mit den neuen Vaternuschen. Wir haben schon fest haben, Agass, wir haben Pound wieder Fad und Nuschen. Meinte Runchen, Wand, der Klecht, Agass, der Kreik, wir, natürlich hieß, Ongreich, wo die Wahrheit Klecht, wir hören Nuschen, Agass. Wie in Party, in Shed Jump Donut. Ding du, wir ne Huschlag ist ne Hüste, Tachtag ist also Tänik, Party, aber wir einigen anders Party. Angst wir reden, unter uns und Herrigen, so sehr reagieren. Es war am Last und Ergas, nether am Mechasige, ad de Kirche, gomme Mischen, goldene Jäg, und durch die Erdego hin. Nether durch, per Naturig.
Seamus Begley with Helen Ní Hay, heard on Unsealo Yass last Tuesday. Leanne McDonough is a mixed media artist who's taking part in Nora Casey's television show, Nora's Traveller Academy. Leanne uses photography and paint to create unique prints inspired by her childhood, and she spoke with Sean Rocks on Arena about what she wanted to achieve in her work.
Conceptually, I want to document community in a way that is more honest and more genuine than has been done previously. I've seen other artists document the community and I've seen it been done in the media, and it's not necessarily always been done in a way that is just purely genuine.
What do you think has been done then that isn't genuine or that represents you and your community incorrectly?
I feel that a lot of people always look for an angle or always portray a certain stereotype, and I have a big problem with the stereotype that is portrayed of travellers because it always seems to be the negative one. Now, I'm fully aware that there are negative things about the travelling community, and I am fully aware that there's travellers out there that behave in a certain way that is not acceptable by society, but nobody can turn around and tell me that any one community on the face of this earth is 100% law-abiding citizens. Nobody can do that. There is the good, the bad and the ugly, no matter where you go or where you're coming from. And I'm aware of that, but the thing is, I'm not like that, and hence people shouldn't perceive me in that way. And I know that there are more travellers out there that are like me, but we're never portrayed in the media. And the thing is, no matter what it is, it doesn't have to be anything to do with travellers. You never see a good news story on the front page of a newspaper. It's always the negative things that sells. And I think this time around, I just want to show a different side to that. I want the good news story to be on the front of the newspaper.
From Wednesday night's Arena. Well, the weather here has been bitterly cold all week, but New York City came to a complete standstill following a weather warning by Mayor Bill de Blasio. John McDonough drives a cab in New York City, and he told Anya Lawler what the shutdown was like.
Mayor de Blasio literally shut down the city of New York for 6 inches of snow. He folded up the tent. In our history, we've never done anything like this, and it was just so ridiculous. And he set New York into a panic. I mean, people were out buying all sorts of food. Like, we wouldn't get out of the house until March. And people were out panic buying, going for gas. And then you wake up this morning, and there's 6 inches of snow.
And for you as a cab driver, I mean, even the subway was closed down, which in New York hardly ever happens. I've seen all kinds of pictures online of, you know, empty New York streets.
Everybody was off the streets by 11 o'clock last night. So the amount of business that was lost, Broadway was closed, everything was shut down. It was definitely a political overreach on de Blasio, who's trying to cover his back in case the 3 feet of snow did come. But he should have reassured New Yorkers that we could be prepared for a foot or two of snow and keep business going. I mean, it's so ridiculous. Last night there was a picture of the naked cowboy in Times Square playing. Now, if the naked cowboy in Times Square can play, surely to God the subways could have ran.
John McDonough heard on the news at 1. Well, yesterday, Marty Morrissey celebrated the end of his programme run by inviting listeners to a Marty party, an afternoon of mayhem, fun and lashings of Dublin Coddle. Shea Healy was there, Claudia Carroll, Andy Irvine, the Kilfenora Cayley Band, and Marty even invited his alter ego, Oliver Callan.
Hi, I'm Marty, president and life founder of There Ain't No Party Like a Non-Stop Electro-Pop, Beat-Bop, All Night Marty's Party. Party. There's only one way to confirm the real Marty. It's a Marty imposter. It's a veritable multiple Marty's Party. We're going to have a test.
Okay.
Who is the real Marty?
Oh,
okay, here we go. There's only one way to confirm that. Let's have a simple quiz. Who invented all-night partying in the 12th century? Was it A, St. Marty in the Fields? B, Marty the Hun? Or C, Marty the Conqueror? What do you say, Imposter Marty?
A.
No! The correct answer, only known to the real Marty, is of course Marty the Hun, patron saint of Copperface Jacks. How about the test? Repeat after me the St. Marty prayer. Holy Moses!
Holy Moses!
Oh!
A classic Olin McGowan production, Oliver Callan trying to out-Marty, Marty Morrissey. Well, among the guests Marty shared coddle with was country sensation Nathan Carter. So I leave you now with his chart-topping version of Bob Dylan's Wagon Wheel. Stay tuned for Richard Curran. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news with The Business. Gurumahagav Oswar Golúther. Gideon Chachtan Chahugin. Gideon Shibslán.
Good afternoon, everybody. Headed down south to the land of the pines, and found my way to North Carolina. Staring up the road, ready guide, I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me up on Cape Dagwood flowers. I'm hoping for rally so I can see my baby tonight. Let's go! So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me. Yeah, rock me, mama, like the wind and the rain. Rock me, mama, like a southbound train. Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me.
Oh, let's go. Woo!
I was running from the cold up a new wind. Was born to be a federal and old time a string band. My baby plays a guitar, I pick the banjo. Oh, the North County winters keep getting me down. I lost my money, been focused, so I had to believe I ain't turning back to live that old life no more, yeah. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me. Yeah, rock me, mama, like the wind and the rain. Rock me, mama, like a southbound train. Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me.
Let's go! Woo!
I was walking to the south out of Roanoke. Got a truck to ride, failing at a nice long took. He said west from the Cumberland Gap to Johnson City, Tennessee. I gotta get a move on before the sun. And my baby called my name, she's the only one. And if I die in a rally, at least I will be free. Yeah. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel.
Sing it.
Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so rock me, mama, like the wind and the rain. Rock me, mama, like a southbound train. Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me. Last cycle. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Hey, hey, yeah, mama, rock me.